It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear. Good morning again, Casey.
Hey, good morning, Kirk. And there's been a lot of stuff that's gone on over the past week, including this whole situation in Ferguson, Missouri, which is very troubling for various different reasons. If you don't know what we're talking about, the young man who was found dead in the street, his body was laying there for, I think they said, about 5 hours before anybody even ever gave him medical attention or even tried to see what was going on. So a very disturbing thing, a young man who was shot, and the whole controversy surrounds this is an African-American young man. The officer, at least according to some accounts, shot him several times when the man wasn't posing a threat to the officer and had his hands up. But there are other accounts that differ. We found out this past week that the officer had an orbital bone that actually... His orbital bone was either fractured or was in some way, you know, not okay, not normal. And so that could suggest perhaps a fight that went on or some sort of, you know, some sort of struggle that went on in terms of a self-defense
situation. Let's not be Nancy Grace here. We don't know all the facts yet because it's still a matter that's under investigation. So
that's very true.
But yes, the ongoing protests, which, you know, are something that naturally happens in response to this kind of situation. But all of the surrounding facts and things that have popped up in the context of this controversy have been, you know, daily news in terms of how it reflects us as a society, how it reflects the relationship between police and the community. And it's really causing, you know, in light of this tragedy, a lot of discussions about reexamining that role. What role do the police really have? And, you know, we always are thankful for the police for the jobs that they do to help our community and to keep it safe. But a lot of the commentary that I've been particularly intrigued by over the past couple of weeks has been this notion that for various reasons, the police have become much more like the military over the course of, you know, decades, really. If we go back to the 70s when SWAT teams were created, and then beyond that when the war on drugs was kicking in and a lot of federal funding that includes not just money but equipment that are very military in nature. And then we have, of course, the war on terrorism that turns even local law enforcement people into, you know, more of a military type role. And if we go back to the history of what police are supposed to be, you know, in our country, you know, I've said this many times, but it's true. If you go back to the time frame when the Constitution was written and when the Bill of Rights were ratified, this was during a period of time when colonial America was responding to the military, the presence of the British, basically constituting martial law and a police state. And a lot of these rights that we have are designed to prevent our society from evolving back into that state. Now, when we have an internal threat of some kind, whether it be a crime that didn't exist, you know, back in the late 1700s, or whether it's a more expansive form of terrorism that we're dealing with in the modern era, or whatever the case may be, it's natural that as our society evolves and as we encounter new problems, that there are adjustments that go that way. But this case really identifies perhaps a pinnacle in that trend, where the confrontation that occurs when a police officer is not in that helping role, not in the, you know, let me help you find your way to the grocery store type role, or not helping the old lady across the street or getting a cat out of a tree, but, you know, basically in a confrontational, warlike setting, dealing with citizenry. Now, even going back to the early 1900s, when some police forces were first being utilized, coinciding with a lot of the uprisings that have occurred in various contexts, including labor or including other types of protests that have been, there's been a function of the police to try and at least contain that type of situation. dealing with a particular crime scenario, however, you know, when it's a police officer there to effect an arrest, gather evidence, or really to the officer's there to protect our rights, not to get rid of them. But I think you can agree, Casey, that we've evolved to a point where the police have turned into much more of a military state than what we ever imagined when we originally contemplated the role of government officials as they interact with citizens.
Well, when you look at it, and I think some of the military vehicles, the military style vehicles that police have now, have evolved really since 9/11. I mean, that's been sort of the focal point as to when this all happened. And a lot of things changed on 9/11, as we know about with our civil liberties and with police vehicles and how those things happen. And, you know, you can understand to a certain point that as technology evolves, you know, it evolves with would-be people who would want to harm the police as well. And so they need angles to combat that. But the weird situation that happened in Ferguson was this one event with this tragic situation where this young man is in the street, he was killed, has evolved into a much larger discussion about what we should do in terms of policing and how communities can interact with their police. I mean, if you look at this, and a lot was focused on the racial makeup of the Ferguson Police Department, right, having three African Americans in a very large force.
And I believe a total of 80 officers.
Right.
Three out of 80 are African American.
Right. So it's a very, very low percentage. And to many, that might seem, well, what's the big deal? Well, you know, the problem is that there are stereotypes that people have about police officers, about members of the community. And if people in the community do not feel like they have a good working relationship with the police, and vice versa, the police having a good working relationship with the community, and if they don't feel like they're adequately represented, then that can cause problems. And we've seen that throughout the United States, and this has really exemplified that in a large way.
I saw another statistic, which is that during the past period of time where they were able to keep these statistics, I'm not sure that they're current as of right now, but I believe it was last year, 80% of the traffic stops or arrests in Ferguson, Missouri, involved black people. And you know, you compare that with there being a very minute percentage of the police force constituting African Americans. So, I mean, it shows, I don't know what we can draw from that other than the fact that there is definitely a disparity. And when most people that are being arrested are a particular ethnic variety, it does raise questions. And these are the types of things that the government studies with a mind's eye towards implementing programs to correct it. But it does leave the big question. I mean, how do you actually get there, assuming that we want to equalize things in that regard? But the one thing that I found so compelling about this particular story is that it says something about not only pervasive views about racism that we still have in our society that we have to continue acknowledging, but also when we have a situation where a community, or at least members of a particular community, are responding in a way that where the violence increases and where people are taking advantage of an opportunity to loot stores or whatever the case may be, we have an additional response where we have to gauge, you know, how the police respond to that particular situation.
Yeah, and that's the other unfortunate thing is that, you know, when you respond, and by the way, we should note that this was a very small percentage of the protesters who were
right.
doing this, but when you respond by looting and burning a store and doing other things of criminal nature, that really detracts from the entire argument and from the entire situation. I mean, and it's unfortunate. So there's a lot going on here. There's also some discussions that are being had about this video that was released
right.
of Michael Brown. Michael Brown was the man who was killed, and the question is now becoming, should they have released this video? What is the video? Well, the video shows, allegedly, Mr. Brown engaged in a strong-armed robbery of a grocery or of a convenience store to get, I believe, a pack of cigarettes.
Or they were cigars.
Or cigars.
$5 pack of cigars.
Right. And so so that's becoming – that was released. And some people thought that was unfair.
I do think. I think it was improper for that to be released for the following reasons. as recently as a little over a week ago, the identity of the officer involved with the incident was still being held secret for various reasons.
Right.
And we talked about that last week, you know, what reasons there might be and the fact that there's an investigation that's underway. It also is abundantly clear, at least from the statements that have been made by the Ferguson police, that this was not anything that was part of the arrest scenario. In other words, this little video clip of Mr. Brown in the convenience store was not the basis for any kind of investigation. In fact, the officer that engaged in the conflict with Mr. Brown had no knowledge of this previous incident. So, you know, that being the case, why on earth would this be released before the identity of the officer?
Well,
and I understand that they're two different things, but doesn't it seem to have the effect? And wouldn't there be a decision somewhere in that chain of command where they're like, oh, hey, this makes this guy look bad. Let's send this out while we're in the process of investigating the guy who we're not even going to say who it is yet.
Well, I'll tell you why I think it has some relevance, and we'll talk about it in just a moment. We do have to take a break. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We're talking about the Ferguson, Missouri situation, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk.
All right, Kirk. So we're talking about this Ferguson, Missouri situation. If you're just joining us, and just to give you a brief background, this was a situation where the young man was shot. The controversy by a police officer, the controversy surrounds whether that was in self-defense, whether the police officer shot in self-defense. He does have some sort of injury to his orbital bone. Or whether that was an unjustified shooting where the man had his hands up. In conjunction with that, the police released a video of Mr. Brown, and in that video, Mr. Brown is allegedly robbing a convenience store, taking a pack of cigars, and leaves the store. I know you think this is irrelevant, Kirk, and I understand the arguments on that, and I think it's a tough argument to make the other way, but let me try, okay? So the reason that I think this could have relevance is twofold. Number one, the timing of it. This happened, apparently, just minutes before Mr. Brown was shot. And the reason I think that's important is because it goes to, not that the officer knew, the officer didn't know. And so it doesn't go to whether the officer felt that he would be a threat. But I think it could go, theoretically speaking, to Mr. Brown's state of mind at the time that he left the store. Because if he was of the state of mind that, okay, I just robbed a store.
He just committed a crime.
I just committed a crime. I'm going to be now more violent or more, I guess I should say, more defensive about what an officer does to me and therefore react more violently compared to the situation where he had been doing nothing wrong.
Well, let me just address that briefly before you go to your next point. Okay. And that is that that's precisely the reason why this video should not have been released. If they can't release the name of the officer, which they have now, but if the rationale behind that is that it's an ongoing investigation and if details of the shooting are not being released because of the fact that there is presumably a grand jury that is going to convene. And, you know, I heard commentary that this is good for the justice system because it's not being directly charged by a district attorney. It's being referred to a grand jury. I have my own views on whether that's appropriate or not, but they're acting like the grand jury is some sort of, you know, impartial mechanism to make sure that it's not being done in such a way that is, you know, an automatic charge. On the other hand, the way grand juries actually work, there's no right to cross-examination. There's no defense attorney. It's basically, you know, a star chamber type situation. And it doesn't result in a conviction. But
and a ham sandwich has been indicted, right?
Yeah, you can indict a ham sandwich very easily.
What about a turkey?
With a grand turkey sandwich is
a little more difficult.
But
okay.
You know, the ham sandwich is definitely within the realm of those things that are indictable. But getting back to if we have this standard, and if the reason why we're not releasing details of this is because it's an ongoing investigation, if on the other hand we have something that makes Mr. Brown look bad, and if it's going to potentially cause the type of speculation that you just engaged in a minute ago by saying, hey, maybe this guy was acting like a criminal in front of the cop. Maybe that explains why he wasn't putting his hands up. Maybe that explains why he was probably engaging in a way that someone who just committed a crime would engage a police officer. Well, don't you see that the speculation is getting further and further out of control? And if it's in the same category of evidence that was gathered, and by the way, you have to presume that the police went back and looked for this surveillance, gathered it as part of the evidence, all the evidence in the case, all the rest of the evidence that we don't know yet, all the other things, witnesses, ballistics, you know, whatever it constitutes that investigation into what happened, this is one piece of it.
Yeah.
Why did this get released? Why this one little piece get released? And then they say, well, he didn't know about it, but, you know, we thought you should know. Don't you think we should know about the rest of it too, or not?
Well, the cynical part of me says the reason it got released is because the police were taking a lot of heat about the fact that this man was shot.
Yeah, it's entirely the wrong reason to release it.
I know. But I think the real reason is they probably wanted to give another side.
I mean, how can you on the one hand say
was?
We're not going to tell you, we understand the public's right to have access to information, we respect the fact that people need to know what's going on, but we can't tell you now because there's this criminal investigation underway, and please be patient with us while we go through the process, and then you'll get all the details you need to make whatever opinions you, the public, will have. Yet, on the other hand, on the left hand, we have this tidbit, this loop that gets played over and over and over again on CNN and headline news and everything else. That obviously has – it's part of the investigation. So they're speaking out of both sides of their mouths
on
this issue.
I agree with you on that. I definitely agree with you on that. Let's move to another angle of this story, which is the grand jury indictment that you just – or the grand jury convening that you just mentioned. The grand jury will in all likelihood indict, I assume. I don't know, but indicting a ham sandwich is a –
Well, it's extraordinarily rare
that
a grand jury doesn't indict because the prosecutor does have complete control over the information that comes before the grand jury.
And let's talk about this prosecutor. This prosecutor is not yet a special prosecutor, although a special prosecutor may be appointed. And the governor of Missouri really has the Governor Nixon has the sole authority to decide whether to appoint a special prosecutor, whether to make the current sitting district attorney step down and prosecute this case. There have been a number of reasons why they said that the citizens are saying that the prosecutor should step down. They believe that he's too closely tied to the police. Well, all prosecutors work with police on a daily basis, on an everyday basis. I think the question comes down to whether he's biased as a prosecutor. But I should point out that he's been elected since 1991, I think every 4 years since that time, by the citizens of Ferguson, Missouri.
Right.
So if there was such a problem with him before, I don't understand why it's now coming up.
But I just wanted to point out that I've heard a lot of commentary that, you know, good for this guy because he decided that it should go to a grand jury. And I get the principle because that is something that is contained within our constitutional rights as one of many mechanisms that protect what we call due process. But, you know, at an early stage of a criminal investigation, sometimes people misunderstand where those rights actually fall and what the purpose behind it is. A grand jury, much like a prosecutor filing a criminal complaint and information, they're really two different ways of achieving the same thing, and there's a trade-off on either one. When we follow the procedure, and just so you know, Casey, I know you already know this, but just so our listeners know, Wisconsin has the availability to do both. The grand jury, however, is never used, and I say never as in exactly, precisely, 0% of the time, in my experience, is there a grand jury that's utilized in this process. That's because the more efficient way of obtaining a criminal charge is to file a criminal complaint, and if it's something that rises to the level of a serious offense, in our state we categorize that as felony. Most states do too, but there are some states that will have a preliminary hearing in lieu of a grand jury, even for more minor offenses, including misdemeanors. But in our state, what happens is a prosecutor typically will draft a criminal complaint, which is it has to state facts that would constitute a crime. Then that is served upon the defendant. The defendant has an opportunity to answer that criminal complaint in several different ways, in open court, with witnesses under oath, and with the assistance of counsel. Those are all things that don't happen in a grand jury. So although there is, you don't have simply a judge determining it like you would in a preliminary hearing associated with a criminal complaint, you have, it's the ultimate paradigm definition of a kangaroo court, in the sense that there is literally no fact-finding litigation that occurs. There is no cross-examination. There is no the defense is not entitled to call witnesses. It's a proceeding that is entirely controlled by the prosecutor. So on the one hand, yes, you are bringing in citizens from the community. I suppose they have the power not to indict. And frankly, we don't know that when it happens, because when there's not an indictment, it's not publicly released. So I suppose it could happen more often than we know about it. But theoretically, what this taps into, and oftentimes it's seen as, you know, a politically more, I guess, a safer method by saying, you know, it wasn't my decision to indict this cop. It was the grand jury.
Well, and the prosecutor has a very difficult role to play. You know, and prosecutors are supposed to be in these situations, you know, very fair. And when you talk about it, if the prosecutor in this case, or, you know, I should say if the grand jury in this case indicts this police officer, there's going to be an uproar. If the grand jury does not indict this police officer, there's going to be an uproar. I mean, there's going to be anger on either side of this, regardless of what happens. This is not going to be some sort of neutral thing. There is controversy on both sides of this issue, and this really plays out.
You raise another point, which is that prosecutors typically are – they work closely with law enforcement, and that's true. And that bothers me to some extent, because it goes beyond working with the police, because they typically are in a role to gather evidence and work and assist the prosecution. But the police serve a very different role than the district attorney's office. I mean, if we were to do this in a completely fair way, you know, they wouldn't be buddies. They wouldn't be friends. They wouldn't be working so closely together. They'd be treated as witnesses like any witness is treated. And, you know, I think that just because of the nature of many criminal prosecutions, things blend into that other territory.
Right.
But theoretically, in our ideal world that doesn't exist, we would like to imagine that prosecutors have an objective and neutral relationship with the police, you know, similar to that which they would have with any witness or anybody involved with a case that who has information that may or may not be relevant to proceedings, and then treat them with the same level of objectivity. Moreover, there's this problem that I think comes down to perception. And I was a prosecutor many years ago. You know that.
Yes.
And yes, it's true. I mean, when you're getting ready for trial, you'll sit there and, you know, you'll have coffee and donuts getting ready for the trial. You'll have your feet up on the desk and you'll say, you know, hey, Sam, the cop, how are your kids doing? You know, you end up in that kind of thing just because you see these people all the time and you engage in regular activity with them. But on the other hand, you know, that type of relationship, even though it's natural and even though it's the kind of thing that occurs in the context of this type of thing, you know, the fact that we have prosecutors that feel a need to disassociate themselves from something like this that is politically charged, well, shouldn't that be something that they're careful of all the time? Isn't that something – doesn't it highlight the fact that if that is true, if the prosecutor says, hey, I'm too close to this case because I'm too close to the cops, well, they shouldn't be too close to the cops in any case. It bothers me.
Right. And we will follow this – we will follow this case. I'm sure we'll have further developments. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
It's true.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
It's a light and tumble journey from the...
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear. Are we already in the third segment?
We are, Kirk.
Wow.
We are. And, you know, Kirk, there was a story that made really international headlines about a woman at the Henry Vilas Zoo in Madison being kicked by a giraffe in the face. Have you heard about this story?
I did hear about it, yes.
So
international news.
Yeah, it really did make international news. It's not always easy to see where that 15 minutes of fame is going to come from. This from the Capital Times. For Amanda Hall, it came with a hoof in the face. All across the U.S. and in Canada, readers are being treated to the exploits of the 24-year-old California woman who breached two fences on Saturday, this past Saturday, to get close and personal with Wally the giraffe at the Vilas Zoo, only to get kicked in the face by the 12-foot animal. She got licked as well. A Google News search yields a growing list of hundreds of news stories on Hall's close encounter, including one from the Los Angeles Times, which tracked the hapless animal lover down for an interview. She said, "He had some grass and nuzzled my head." She's now nursing her wound below her lip that required 10 stitches. She says, "He licked me, and then I got a kick to the chin. It was a shock." Hall, who admitted hopping...
Wait, what did she expect?
Well, yeah, right, exactly. Well, giraffes look like nice, warm, fuzzy animals. And
nice, warm, but they're like, 35 feet tall.
They're really tall. They are really tall, but don't they look kind of friendly, or do you think they don't?
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe not. Hall, who admitted hopping the 3-foot fence, said that she's planning to challenge the $686 fine that she was issued for harassment of a zoo animal.
Is she saying she was the one who was harassed?
Here's her defense. She says, "I got hit in the face by a giraffe. I had to deal with all of that. That was a lot of pain to deal with already. I don't need a fine and this on my record. I don't harass zoo animals. I'm an animal lover."
But she was going to go there to love the giraffe.
Yes, but she did apologize to the zoo for stepping over the line. She says, "Obviously, I won't do it again. The barricade is there for a reason. I just didn't think twice about it. I just didn't think it was a big deal." Now, since that time, she has decided to pay the fine.
Oh.
She says that it was a free zoo. "I was visiting a friend in Wisconsin. We'd been riding bikes all day and decided to stop in." Hall said she rarely visits zoos because she doesn't like seeing animals cooped up. She said the giraffe ate from her hand, licked her, and then kicked her in the chin. So she is...
Let me just back up a second here, because this is one of those rules, and there is a law, but it's kind of a dumb law because you figure no one's going to break it. You know,
right, right.
It's like the law against don't walk an elephant on a sidewalk. Okay, well, that's kind of unnecessary because, you know, not many people even have elephants, and they don't go walking them on sidewalks. So it's one of those rules that you almost think is kind of self-enforcing because you don't need to specify. But so, when I'm at the zoo, and I agree with this. I don't like going to the zoo because I don't like seeing the animals in captivity. On the other hand, there are people that love animals that are involved in the whole zoo world. And, there's a rehabilitative function for injured animals. And there is also studying and learning about animals. And some that are in captivity, it's not quite the same as, it'd be one thing if you had an orca, for example, in captivity and what happens.
Right.
And you saw the movie Blackfish about all that. And very disturbing about the whole industry behind all that.
Yeah.
But if we're talking about zoos in general, they have a fence, and most human beings know what a fence is there for, okay? And then you've usually got like a moat or something
There was no moat here.
Okay,
though.
Well, no moat, yeah. But the point is there's at least a barrier that is, it's a two-way street, you see. See, now, I don't know if I need to explain this to you, but I probably need to explain it to this lady. When a fence is there, it keeps the animal in, but it also keeps the people out. See what a brilliant invention it is?
A fence is a very good idea.
It does both things.
Yes, it
Isn't
does
that
do
great?
Both things.
It's a multifunctional device.
It is.
It keeps people out. So when there's a fence there and there's a wild animal, well, it might be less wild than if it were in the wild, but when there's a 35-foot tall creature that could definitely kick your butt, if not your chin, that's just common sense. I know we have laws that say, hey, don't climb the fence and go in and, party with the grizzly bears. I mean, yeah, we figure that's self-enforcing. We figured that that's something that, you got to be really stupid to even violate that law. But, just for good measure, the icing on the cake, the cherry on top is, hey, we got a law against that,
too.
Well,
what if it's the giraffe like the one from Sesame Street? Isn't that
The problem is that no giraffe is like the one on Sesame Street.
Because he's a nice giraffe.
Yeah.
He's a very nice guy.
It's like saying, I saw Oscar the Grouch behind the fence, and I thought I'd, see if he's grumpy. puppy or not, you know. Well, that's not even a real animal, but
right.
Or Big Bird. What about Big Bird?
Big Bird.
Like, hey, right. there's a vulture back there, and he kind of reminds me of Big Bird, except he's not yellow, so
exactly.
I'm going to go snuggle with him.
Exactly.
The problem is that when somebody does something really stupid like this, and the fact that she acted indignant, like, hey, I'm an animal lover, I'm different than everybody else here, that fence doesn't apply to me, it's for the animal haters, it's, you know, that's to protect the animal from people, you know, the haters
well,
out there.
But let me defend this.
So she's like, I've got punishment enough because I got kicked in the face by a giant animal.
Can I just want to defend this woman for 1 second here, okay? a little more than 1 second. I looked up the actual ordinance, the Madison City Ordinance, the law that prohibits harassment of zoo animals. It's at 23.195 of the ordinances of the city of Madison. It shall be unlawful for any person to frighten, intimidate, abuse, harass, strike, disturb, or tease any animal located within Henry Vila Zoo property. It shall be unlawful for any unauthorized person to throw or place any object inside any animal exhibit space located within Henry Vila Zoo property.
That's where she's guilty. She placed herself.
Well, but she didn't place an object.
She's an unauthorized object.
Well, I think they're referring to other objects.
Well, it doesn't say that.
To other things. It shall be unlawful.
What is an object? An object is a thing. An object is something that is a physical, takes up physical space. It has mass.
Boy, we're going to have to go back and look at the intent of this ordinance. But I believe it's referring to, you know, sort of foreign objects, things that aren't
human. Okay, so your interpretation, if you're right about this, is that, you know, the fence is there to keep people from throwing popcorn and rubber balls at the bears and that kind of thing. But feel free to jump in and play with the animals.
I think the jumping in part,
as long as you're doing it in a loving, cuddly sort of way.
I think the jumping in part applies to sub one, which is, it shall be unlawful for any person to, and this could be accomplished by going in there, frighten, intimidate, abuse, harass, strike, disturb, or tease any animal. So that would apply to somebody going in there. But I don't understand how, okay, she didn't frighten the animal, clearly, because the animal licked her face and then kicked her, although maybe you could argue that was frightening. She didn't intimidate the animal. She was trying to feed it grass. She didn't abuse the animal. She didn't. I don't think she harassed the animal. She certainly didn't strike the animal. She got struck by the animal. You could make
she struck the hoof with her chin. You could say that.
Well, the hoof struck her.
Well, I suppose.
I guess an argument could be made that she disturbed the animal because that was the reason for this for Wally's reaction. But I don't think she was teasing the animal. I'm not sure that the intent of this statute really fits.
Well, if that's the case, and let's look at the broader intent of this statute, which is basically they came up with a long list of different ways that you're not supposed to jump in the cage with the animal, okay? Well, and maybe that falls in that category that I said before.
We don't need a lot.
You don't have to say, you know, that here's a Siberian tiger, and we don't want you to harass, throw, you know, or tease the animal. Do we have to add there, you know, don't throw your body, which is a 180-pound piece of meat, into the cage with the animal while you're at it? You know, do you think it would it have been clearer for you, and would it have absolved your conflict in your mind about this statute if they had added the fact that, oh, by the way, don't place yourself, which is, you know, you are often seen as food for this animal, inside the cage if you're an unauthorized person?
I think that they felt that they didn't need to put that in. I think you're exactly
right.
Right,
right. It's kind of self-enforcing because you know what happens? If you do, you get eaten or kicked by the giraffe.
And can I tell you about one other thing that's happened? This isn't the first time that something like this has happened. And this was actually a really sad one, but in March of 1988, there was a popular polar bear named Chief who was shot by a police officer who probably saved the life of a mentally ill man who had jumped into Chief's unbared pen. He mauled the man, who ended up living, but Chief died. And after the 1988 incident, two previous confrontations between visitors and animals at the zoo were recalled in a Wisconsin State Journal article. In 1934... A 9-year-old boy was mauled by a polar bear at the zoo. The boy and his friends had been swinging from a vine next to the polar bear cage, and the bear reached through the bars with one paw, pulled the boy toward the cage. The boy died from his injuries a week later. In June of 1966, you love history, Kirk, so you find this interesting, a 3-year-old girl was killed when Winky, an elephant at the zoo, threw her down and stomped on her. The girl had ventured too near the cage to offer the elephant popcorn. So, obviously, these are little kids. This is a very serious situation. This is a very dangerous situation. And you're right. This probably will never happen again. And we will continue with this story. We'll follow up on this story. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk.
All right, Kirk. So there was a situation that was very serious down in Madison with a death, a pedestrian collision. And this happened, I believe, the crash happened back in September 2011. And I will just read from this Channel 3000 story. It says, a charge against a 33-year-old Portage man accused of killing a pedestrian in Madison while driving under the influence of a narcotic pain reliever has been dismissed. Jonathan Radance was charged with homicide by negligent use of a vehicle in connection with a crash in September of 2011. Dane County DA Ishmael Ozan told News 3 that the charges were dismissed because the judge ruled that the methadone evidence was not admissible, and they decided they didn't have enough evidence to prosecute the case. The defense maintained that the drug had only been in his system for 7 minutes, not the 45 minutes that their experts were prepared to tell the court that it would take to have an effect on the body. Radance said that he had been driving when Campbell, who had several impairments, which made walking difficult for her, fell in the street. But he wasn't speeding, said defense attorney Mark Eisenberg. We had an expert testify that he was going 12 to 15 miles per hour. He felt terrible about the lady, but he really didn't think that he'd done anything wrong other than it was a traffic accident. So Campbell later died from her injuries, and this was it's a methadone case. So it's a case where usually people take methadone either for pain relief or to counteract the effects of an opioid such as heroin or some other drug.
It's typically used as a less addictive and impairing method of weaning somebody from an opioid addiction.
Right, exactly. That's what I mean. And so in this situation,
Medically prescribed.
Right, medically prescribed. And a lot of people are confused about this because they don't do this every day. They don't work in this every day. You can be charged with an OWI-related offense and operating while under the influence for prescription medications, for things that you are validly prescribed.
That you take as prescribed.
That you take as prescribed. Including, by the way, antidepressant medications, anti-anxiety medications, if they have certain effects.
Well, let's be clear. There are certain categories, and unfortunately, the law is a bit vague on this issue because we have three categories of impaired offenses. There's the good old classic drunk driving where you drink alcohol to the point where you become impaired or you have a prohibited alcohol concentration of 0.08 or more. Then we have those cases where either through alcohol or some substance, the person exhibits impairment, but not to any sort of prescribed level. And that's where we have this gray zone. The third area, which is the per se law, whereas if somebody has restricted, prohibited, controlled substance in their system, you know, your classic cocaine, heroin, marijuana, that kind of thing.
Right.
If it's in certain forms, you know, you have to have delta 9 THC, not just the metabolites and so forth. But in the middle is that gray area where any kind of impairment caused by ingestion of a prescription medication, and it kind of overlaps with enough alcohol to impair you, but not over the legal limit type thing. it's a problem in our society right now because you can see reasons why that should be against the law. However, I think most citizens that receive prescriptions don't get the same kind of warnings across the board for all types of medications that can cause impairment. Now, there are some that are obvious. You know, if you get a prescription for Ambien, for example, it's obvious that you're not supposed to go out and drive because what Ambien does is it puts you to sleep. And right. most people, well, let's just assume the fact that you're not supposed to be driving whilst sleeping. So if we can presume that as a basis for the continued discussion here, don't drive while you're sleeping, don't sleep while you're driving. Now, let's go beyond that. Drugs that contain narcotics that are prescribed also cause some degree of impairment because of the fact that it lowers a person's inhibitions or it makes it so the person has difficulty exercising their judgment in a particular way or coordination that is affected.
Well, but let's also be clear about this, because one thing that's important to note is that there are medical doctors, and you and I aren't medical doctors and not going to play one on the radio, but it should be important to note that you should
can I be Doogie Howser?
Yes, you could be Doogie Howser.
Or House. I like House.
Yes.
I like House.
Yes. Oh, Dr. House. Yeah, Dr. absolutely. House. But you should very seriously consult with your physician before driving, even if you're prescribed medications that your doctor legally prescribes to you. Because you can end up in a DUI type situation in something where you didn't feel that.
And we see lots of cases where, you know, it's perhaps in that easier realm, because when you get the prescription bottle and by golly, when you're being given the Ambien, that the pharmacist is supposed to tell you, look, don't drive with this, okay? And then there's a big yellow sticker or red sticker on the prescription bottle with, you know, a car and a line through it, and it says don't drive and all those other things. But the real problem is where we have other controlled substances that are prescribed and a person takes them as prescribed. And you mentioned earlier some antidepressants. Now, the goal of an antidepressant or an anti-anxiety medication when prescribed is to make the person feel normal.
Exactly.
And if it's working and if it's being taken properly as the doctor prescribes, the other problem as it relates to this particular area of law is that depending upon the nature of your disorder, if you want to call it that. But let's just say you have generalized anxiety disorder and you have a prescription for something that makes that better. There is a period of adjustment when you're getting that medication. Depending upon your weight, your age, other medical considerations, and how severe your anxiety is, you may have a broad range of how much you are supposed to take. So there's no like standard dosage for these things. And if the idea is that if you become accustomed to it to the point where it balances your body chemistry and you are functioning well, better than if you didn't have the medication, then that's precisely what it's supposed to accomplish, including driving.
And you and I have both had doctors tell us that, in fact, one of the reasons that they prescribe these medications, you know, that some doctors will say, hey, you know, we don't want this person out on the road if they have severe anxiety that's being untreated, or they have severe depression, because they might do erratic things. They might drive in erratic ways. They might make us less safe. So what do? We put them on certain medications that will make them more safe and more safe drivers.
And this is where I think...
Then they get nabbed for OWI.
This is where I think the methadone thing comes into play, because, you know, I think it's fairly common knowledge, but for those of you that don't know, methadone is used to treat opiate addiction withdrawal. Now, you can make whatever judgment you want about somebody who has taken an illegal controlled substance such as heroin or other opiates, and you know, that being an illegal and perhaps wrong decision. But I would point out, you know, people become addicted to opiates legally as well because they are prescribed. But given the fact that the body has some pretty profound changes that it goes through when it becomes accustomed to the introduction of opiates into it, there is a very difficult process of reversing that course. And it's never fully reversed, because once someone has had an opiate in their system, their body chemistry technically does change forever, depending upon the receptors and how often it's used and that kind of thing. But given the fact that when somebody is going through withdrawal, from an addiction, and again, this is a medical issue, not necessarily a legal issue, but that person suffers extreme discomfort, pain, shaking, neurological symptoms, pretty serious psychological symptoms as well, lack of sleep, lack of appetite, all kinds of things because the body has become used to having that opiate in its system, and right. it basically rejects the non-existence of the opiate. So methadone, when prescribed properly, is something that counteracts those negative withdrawal symptoms. And again, make whatever moral judgment call you want, but I don't think the law contemplates that somebody who becomes addicted to an opiate then goes through treatment to alleviate that addiction and reverse it, hopefully, to the extent that you can, and not be in a state of physical and psychological pain manifested through physiological right. symptoms
right.
like shaking and double vision and those kinds of things. So if what it does is it makes a person feel normal, not under the influence of anything, including withdrawal, I mean, that's something. There is no principle in our society that says that person should not drive because of being in a particular category.
Right. And now what we have is we have experts coming in on behalf of the prosecution that are stating that this person was impaired because they took their although they took their prescription medications, we believe they were impaired because this type of a drug would have X, Y, and Z effects on somebody. It would make them tired. Yeah. It would make them sleepy. And, well, drugs have different effects on
right, and
all
the science
kinds of
really isn't as well developed as we'd like to think.
Absolutely.
In that area.
And you and oftentimes these quote unquote experts do not know how a person metabolizes that particular drug. They don't know the person's tolerance to that particular drug. They don't know the effects that it has. They don't know a lot of things about the person that they would need to know theoretically to render an opinion as to whether that prescription medication would cause impairment on the driver.
Right. And unfortunately, the way that impairment is proven in these types of there's no way to prove it other than field sobriety tests. And unfortunately, field sobriety tests, there are many people that would not pass any of them if they were stone cold sober.
That's right.
And it's almost proving a negative by negative evidence that, you know, proving the existence of something by a negative. And it's a bit of a bizarre process. But I really do believe that we need to do something to, you know, as long as a person is not exhibiting dangerous driving behavior, and there needs to be the possibility within our law that simply because a person takes a medication that in some cases can cause impairment and in others doesn't necessarily, and that's where the science is not as well developed. We've spent hundreds of years, well, at least 100 anyway, developing the science behind what ethanol does to people, and that's relatively consistent and reliable. But the whole world of what medication does to people is so... it's not as firmly developed within the science involved. And if we have laws where people, if every person who took some kind of medication that has the potential to impair them is not allowed to drive a vehicle, I think our society would, you know, have a problem because that's a lot of people.
We'd come to a screeching halt.
Yeah.
All right. All right, well, this has been another edition of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Remember, you can join us every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 right here on 1330 WHBL.